Ark Entertainment presents an Alpine Median production. Grey-haired Professor Jonathan Maxwell teaches a class at a university.
There was a time when it was believed that the shape of a person's head, its dimensions, could tell you if that person was a criminal. Those theories, now discredited, helped establish the study of crime and of criminals. Criminology.
He writes the word on a blackboard.
You know, like all sciences, or maybe I should say disciplines, the study of crime has really changed a lot over the years. You know, one of the earliest formal methods of studying crime was called phrenology. And then, of course, we've had fingerprinting for a long time, but up to that was considered to be the most exact science for determining who a person was. But, of course, now we have DNA. And that is the exact science for determining who's guilty and who's innocent. But in this course, we're not going to deal so much with the criminalistics as we are with the psychology of crime.
What? Yes. May I help you?
What are you doing?
Oh, I'm Professor Maxwell. I'm doing a class on beginning criminology.
That's fine. Except I'm Professor Fulton, and this is my intro biology class.
Biology. Oh, right.
Then, this is not Haney Hall.
No.
It would help a lot if all these buildings didn't look exactly alike.
It might.
First day of the semester, I think it's a little confusing.
Seems that way.
Class, I'll tell you what we're going to do is I'm going to turn the class over to Professor Fulton here, who's going to lecture you on the fascinating subject of biology. I mean, where would we be without biology, of course? Back in the Dark Ages, probably. Thank you. Sorry, or maybe in the right classroom.
After bumping into a skeleton, Jonathan leaves the classroom. In association with Larry Levinson Productions, Murder 101, Dick Van Dyke, Barry Van Dyke, Tracy Needham, William Alan Young. A figure wearing latex gloves carefully works with small bottles of chemicals and intricate tools. A sign on a box reads, Plastic Explosives. The figure strips the plastic insulation from the end of a length of electrical wire. Wires are attached to a circuit board and soldered into place. Tony Dennison, Lisa Thornhill, Bradford English, Carmen Argenziano, Roxanne Hart, John Rosenfeld, Blake Lindsley. Detonators are pressed into a block of plastic explosive and red lights flash on a small electronic device. Herschel Sparber, Lucy Butler, Joe Howard. Well-dressed guests mingle at a party in a vast white house. Nelson, a handsome grey-haired man with an elegant fair-haired woman, Betty. He finishes his drink.
That was nice. Think I'll have another. Oh, you don't disapprove, do you?
I wouldn't know how.
Well, it's not like we can't afford it. Omnicom is the success story of our times. Or didn't your husband mention?
You're not that successful, Nelson.
Don't lecture me.
By all means, have another.
Casting by Penny Perry, Amy Reese. Music by Roger Bellin. Edited by Colleen Halsey, ACE. Production designer Joseph B. Tintfass. Director of photography Amit Bhattacharya. An SUV pulls up outside the house and an auburn-haired woman of about 40 gets out. Executive producer Dean Hargrove. Co-executive producers Nick Lombardo, Michael Moran. Produced by Kyle Clark, James Wilberger. Written by Dean Hargrove. Directed by Christian I. Nyby II. The auburn-haired woman comes into the party and gets herself a drink. A short-haired young guy, Charles Burke, comes over to her.
Don't forget I owe you a dinner.
I'm counting the hours.
A middle-aged guy, Max, stops her.
Stop by my office tomorrow. I'll give you a news release on a corporate bond issue I'm getting approved.
Absolutely.
And, you know, lobbyist is not a four-letter word.
No, it's eight.
Damn decent of you to show up.
So sorry.
You know, the dinner is probably an iceberg by now. Who the hell do you think you are?
Mr. Raymond, I'm...
Everyone thinks you're this girl from the PR department on the make. They don't know that you're willing to do whatever you can to get the inside story on us for that rag you secretly write for. Yeah, that's right. She's an investigative reporter for Financial Press, hoping to bring down the company with a smear campaign against me and any of you she can get her claws into.
You are drunk.
Nelson, that's enough.
Sure as hell is. I never liked her, and I never trusted her. She's a spy, and I can prove it.
You're a liar.
You might have gotten away with it if you slept with me, too.
All right. We've all had enough fun for tonight. The party's over.
I want to see you in my office in the morning.
Yes, sir.
The guests leave the party. The auburn head woman, Cheryl, walks towards the door, and Nelson grabs her arm.
Not so fast.
We still have lots we have to talk about.
Betty and her husband, Carl, come out.
Unbelievable. I can't believe it.
I'm gonna take Nelson seriously.
Wouldn't put it past her.
I don't want to believe it.
Carl and Betty reach their luxurious black car, and Betty watches Nelson and Cheryl arguing through the window of the house.
I don't envy her.
Carl glances back at the house, then turns to Betty, who gets in the passenger seat of the car. Carl walks round to the driver's side.
You could really save yourself the headache and some cost of jail time.
Later, the cars have gone, as Cheryl, who wears a small black evening dress, comes out of the house. She walks down a small flight of stone steps outside the entrance and sidles over to her SUV. Cheryl grabs the handle on the driver's door. She shudders in shock as a vast, fiery explosion blasts all the windows out of the house. Cheryl stares at the wrecked house. Later, the house is cordoned off with police tape and emergency vehicles are parked outside. A middle-aged detective shows something to colleagues.
There you go.
A corpse in a body bag is wheeled out on a gurney. Lieutenant Dietrich, a handsome guy with short afro hair, steps over to Cheryl.
Are you okay, miss?
Yes, I'm fine. Thank you.
Look, we just may ask you a few more questions, so you don't intend to leave town soon, do you?
No. Why do you ask? I thought this was a gas leak or something.
Yeah, that was my first guess, too.
And what was it?
Well, it seems the firefighters found an incendiary device.
So what does that mean?
Well, they'll have to check it out to be certain, but it looks like this thing could have been set off with a remote control.
Is that possible?
Well, nothing's ever 100%, but these firefighters rarely make a mistake on something like this.
But who would have set it off?
Miss, she'd be surprised at what some people would do. Please.
He opens the SUV driver's door for her, and she gets in.
You know, I wasn't a big fan of his. It's a horrible way to die. You'll let me know what you find out?
You'll be one of the first. Drive safe now.
Dietrich, who wears jeans, a dark casual jacket and maroon round-necked top, watches with keen interest as Cheryl backs up her SUV and drives away. At the university, Jonathan's addressing his real class.
Of course, there are certain questions the criminal justice system must answer. For instance, does the suspect have a sufficient motive? Did he have an opportunity? And in the absence of any kind of a legitimate confession, what kind of evidence is there? Eyewitness? Circumstantial? Or forensic? No, this is the most heinous crime an individual can commit. And as criminologists, what we're interested in is why. Why do people kill other people?
Having underlined the word murder on the blackboard, Jonathan smiles at his class. Handsome 50-ish Mike Bryant strolls along a sun-kissed beach. He wears a black wetsuit and carries a surfboard under his arm. He strolls towards the street, then notices a plum-coloured Porsche being driven away on the back of a flatbed truck.
That's my car.
Hey! 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 That's my car! Hey!
He runs after the truck, which drives away.
Hey!
Oh, man.
The truck carries on driving. Mike drops his surfboard on his toe.
Ow!
Cursing, he picks up his surfboard and shirt and marches away.
Oh, man.
Jonathan's teaching.
You know, most murders are committed for very mundane reasons. Passion, race hatred, revenge, and the ever-popular greed.
A student puts her hand up.
Yes, Henrietta.
Professor Maxwell, where do serial killers fit into this?
Oh, they're in a league by themselves, Henrietta. We're going to deal with that a little later in the term. But right now, I'm interested in people more like ourselves. You know, any one of us is capable of committing a murder under the right set of circumstances.
Even professors of criminology.
That depends on the quality of your term paper, Henrietta. But no, most of us usually don't go around committing murders. So when one of us, usually law-abiding citizens, does, we have to search out why.
He chucks down a letter, then pulls his wetsuit top down off his shoulders and presses a button on his answering machine.
Hello, I'm calling in regard to your credit card account. You're delinquent 90 days, and your credit rating is in jeopardy.
Mr. Parker, this is your auto leasing company. You're 3 payments behind, so we're proceeding with reclamation of your vehicle. If you have any questions, please call 818.
Mr. Parker, this is Elena in Joan St. John's office. Ms. St. John needs your services on a case. Could you please call me? Thank you.
Mike quickly picks up his phone and dials.
Office.
Hey, Elena, it's Mike.
Hi.
Yeah, I just got your message.
Yes, are you available for a case?
Am I available? When does she want me to start?
Immediately.
Oh, well, let's see. Yeah, I guess I could shuffle a few things around and start, oh, say this morning?
I'm glad you could accommodate us.
Hey, for Joan, I will always make the time.
Thank you, Mike.
Yeah, give her my best, will you?
Bye now.
Thanks.
He dials another number.
Easy, Al.
Hey, Charlie.
You! This call better make me happy.
Charlie, lighten up, will you? Look, I've been out of the country for a few months working on a very important case. You know how my job is.
I know it doesn't pay. I want my money.
I don't blame you, but I got a check for you.
No kidding?
No, I'm not kidding.
In full?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah, just have somebody over here by 10 to take me to the yard to get my car.
All right.
Charlie, you are the man.
In his rustic-style home, Jonathan holds a tin of cat food.
Samantha! Giddy, giddy, giddy!
Now recap.
Showtime.
Yesterday evening, Nelson Raymond, chief financial officer of corporate giant Omnicom, was brutally murdered in an explosion at his home. Seen here earlier today is Cheryl Collins, an investigative reporter who is the primary suspect in the bombing. In other news, the city council announced yet again plans to bring a major...
Fascinated by the Nelson murder story, Jonathan absent-mindedly eats a spoonful of cat food and grimaces. He turns off the TV and locks the back door.
See you tonight.
He ambles through his dining area and picks his leather messenger case up off the table. He hasn't noticed his set of keys still lying on the table. Jonathan strolls out of his house, then suddenly freezes as the door shuts behind him. He pats his jacket pockets, then turns back to the door, but it's shut fast. He walks around to a window, peers inside and sees his keys lying on the table. He curses. His long-haired white cat, Samantha, comes out through the cat flap in the back door. Jonathan walks over to the back door, then quickly walks back again. At police headquarters, Mike reads a file as he walks down a corridor with Dietrich.
That's pretty much it.
Well, the co-worker said the two of them had a thing going, and the eyewitness said that they had a big fight the night he was killed.
Accused her of being an undercover reporter. How's that work?
Well, I don't know. You gotta ask her.
You guys found some C4 in her garage.
It's the same stuff the firefighter said caused the explosion. Along with some wires, a couple of fuses, you know, just the usual stuff we all have in our garage.
Could have been planted.
Yeah, right. And if frogs had wings, they wouldn't live in the swamps.
Come on, Mike, you were a cop. Now you know we've got enough here for a righteous bust. Omnicom's right up there with Enron. Must be a lot of heat to nail her.
Well, the investigation's not over yet. Never know what might pop up. Well, you know that better than anybody, Mike. Isn't that why you're out there making the big bucks instead of being in here with the good guys?
Scowling, Mike gives the file to Dietrich and steps into an empty office where Cheryl's waiting.
Miss Collins, I'm Mike Bryant. I've been retained as an investigator on your case by Miss St. John.
I've already told her everything I know.
Well, it would help me if I could hear it from you.
Go ahead. I don't seem to have any pressing engagements.
Anything you tell me will have the same confidentiality as you'd have with an attorney.
First question.
Who had a motive to kill Raymond?
At Omnicom, for starters.
Well, the company is a real rat's nest. All the major players were at the party. Carl Larch, president and CEO of Omnicom. He's responsible for all of their real estate, energy, cable TV interests. Was a one-time pitch man for bodybuilding miracles. Probably only a couple of steps away from an indictment on fraud charges. Larch's wife, Betty, the resident Black Widow, reputed to be the brains behind the brains. Charles Burke, head of marketing, and I suspect procurement for the rest of the boys' club. On the Omnicom board is a former lobbyist who knows where the bodies are buried. Probably buried a few himself.
Were you having an affair with Raymond?
Next question.
I'll take that as a no. With anyone at Omnicom?
Good question. No.
The night he was murdered, Raymond accused you of being an investigative reporter working undercover. Now, what was that about?
Well, it's true. I was sent in by financial press to investigate some possible bookkeeping. A couple months ago, I got an anonymous tip that Omnicom is the next Enron. My publisher knows that this is big news, so I'm sent in. He calls in a favor from a PR firm, doctors up a resume, and since I can be charming at times, these well-tailored goons hired me.
What was your connection to Raymond?
Well, he's the chief financial officer, so he's the best source. I tell him I'm developing a PR piece on the company. I get an editor at the press to guarantee that it will run. And I convince Raymond that he's going to be a star.
So why did he turn on you?
I have no idea.
Is that Cheryl Collins your real name?
Well, I wouldn't lie about that. It's easier to keep my story straight.
Clever girl.
We'll see.
Mike purses his lips and nods. Dietrich comes into the office.
Miss Collins, you're free to go.
Are you dropping the charges?
She made bail.
I thought it was set at $1 million.
Her publisher managed to put up the necessary 10%.
He likes my writing.
Since we're supposed to keep the defense informed, my men just checked this out.
Was it a remote that set off the bomb?
Same frequency.
Prince?
Smudged.
So why are you showing me this?
We just found that under a mat in the trunk of your car.
You really think she'd keep it with her?
I'm the one who called the police.
Well, the cynic might say that that was a real clever move, that you didn't have a chance to get rid of it.
I went straight home after I saw you.
If it was her, she could have just dropped it on the way.
Except I had her followed. She never had a chance to get around to the trunk of that car before we brought her in. Unless you have anything else to say, you can go.
Cheryl and Mike walk down a corridor together.
So now what do we do?
Now you go home. And don't take any calls unless they're from Joan St. John or me.
Want to avoid the press?
Especially the press.
In the elegant grounds of the Red Brick University, a large red banner reads, Bovard, USC 125. Jonathan comes out holding his messenger case. He dodges a young student and deftly straddles a concrete bollard. As he walks towards the courtyard, he sees Mike waiting for him.
What's the hurry? I've got to feed that cat. It's going to be hell to pay. What are you doing here?
Thought I'd buy you lunch.
Oh. Isn't it my turn?
Actually, it is.
Good, good. I didn't forget. Which means you want some.
I do, but I'm willing to pay for it. I ordered your favorite, Ching Lao's, for lunch.
Oh, Chinese? Where's the twice-cooked pork?
Here you go. Here's a napkin. You know what? You better take two.
Didn't bring a fork, did you?
They sit on a bench.
Were you taking all of those?
I'm going to save them for later. Want some more rice?
It's fried.
So?
You know I don't like fried rice.
You love fried rice.
Your daughter loves fried rice. I like brown rice.
Oh. I guess that means you're not my daughter.
Glad we got that straight.
So what do you think of this young woman defendant?
She's smart.
Well, that helps. You think she's innocent?
Yeah, I do.
She's attractive then, huh?
Yeah, and it's got nothing to do with it. I just think she's too smart to knock somebody off this way. And if she didn't have an affair with the victim, she's got no motive.
Well, we don't know that for sure, though, do we? If she didn't have an affair.
I don't know, John. She was on an important assignment. It's just, it's out of character.
She's also an investigative reporter, and they can learn to put up some pretty fancy facades.
Mm. Meaning maybe I'm not seeing her clearly?
Didn't say that.
How long have we known each other, John? 30 years?
32. You just got back from Vietnam.
Right. And thanks to you, I straightened up and studied criminology. So anyway, you'll meet her and you'll judge for yourself.
I'm meeting her?
You told me you'd help me on this case. You didn't forget that, did you?
You're playing on my absent-mindedness is very low. We both know I didn't promise you anything.
She'll help because you're intrigued.
Maybe.
Maybe you'll help or maybe you're intrigued.
I'm intrigued and maybe I'll help.
Using chopsticks, Jonathan digs a morsel of food out of his takeaway carton. Cheryl's SUV pulls into the driveway of her attractive suburban home. She opens a door in the tall wall surrounding her garden and steps inside. Cheryl walks down a flight of stone steps, unlocks her door and goes into her house. Inside, a figure in black wearing black leather gloves half closes a closet door, then skulks away as Cheryl comes down the stairs. She looks around her kitchen and notices that the door to an office room is wide open. Cheryl takes a silver candlestick from a shelving unit and holds it poised as she cautiously steps through into the office room. In the office is a desk with a computer on it, and behind that a couple more units with lots of books on the shelves. Holding the candlestick ready, she steps up to an open window and closes it. Cheryl comes out of the office, then notices the closet door ajar. She opens it and peers inside. The figure in black shoves her into the closet, then slams the door and drags a heavy shelving unit in front of it, trapping her. In the darkness of the closet, Cheryl pulls out her mobile phone and dials. Mike's Porsche speeds over to Cheryl's house and stops outside. A squad car and ambulance are already there. Mike jumps out of his car and runs over to Cheryl.
You okay?
Mostly angry. No, I didn't get a good look at him.
Well, doesn't look like a burglary. Any idea what they were looking for?
Not a clue.
All right, we're done.
Mike runs over to Dietrich.
Look, I know this doesn't mean much to you, but if she wanted to stage a stunt, wouldn't she make it look like the intruder had a purpose?
Or she tried to establish that somebody else had access to her house, went in and put the C4 in her garage. Tell you what, when we find that somebody, I'll ask her.
Dietrich gets into his car, and Mike strides over to Cheryl.
Anybody else have a key to the place?
No. But anybody at work could have lifted it, made a copy.
I'll have the locks changed. If you need me, don't hesitate to call, okay?
And just what exactly are you going to be doing?
Well, we go to work.
Who is we? Well, you have a staff?
You might say that, yeah.
He grins. Investigators are still examining the wreckage outside Nelson's house as Mike drives up in his convertible Porsche with Jonathan beside him in the passenger seat. They both get out and climb the stone steps leading to the front entrance. Jonathan and Mike step into the blown-out house. Dietrich and some other officers are in there.
Too much. I mean, it's burning it on 300 feet per
second. Jonathan steps over to a blasted-out window.
What's that?
He leans out.
Looks like the blast came from about here.
You should have been a cop, Professor.
I don't think I'd be much good anymore. Can't remember what I had for lunch. Did we have lunch?
Dessert's in your pocket.
Oh. Are there any pictures of the room before the blast?
Yeah, I'll get them to you. I still say that you should have been working with us on this one.
Thought you had a winner, Dietrich.
No, we do. I'd still like to have him on our side.
Well, if she turns out to be guilty, not much I can do about that. Where was her car parked?
Outside to the left, 50 yards.
Excuse me.
He goes outside.
Thanks,
sir. Hey, Johnson.
Officer Johnson walks straight past Mike without acknowledging him. Mike sighs, and Dietrich steps over to him.
How long do you figure I'm going to have to put up with that rap?
Probably until those cops that you testified against get out of the joint.
They were dirty, and you know it.
All the same, Mike, there's just some guys who feel that you're not one of us.
Since when?
Since you turned in your badge.
I didn't get a look at them at all.
What would they want to take from her kitchen?
Well, fingerprints, maybe. Nothing on this knob probably been wiped clean. You know, if they planted traces of that C4 in the garage, they would probably just be a thorough.
What do you mean, if they planted it? You don't believe me?
Oh, I have no reason to doubt you at all, but the police do. You want to show us around?
Sure. Whoever broke in here tried to access my computer files. They didn't find my backup.
Oh, nice setup.
Well, I do a lot of freelance work besides the financial press. Sometimes reports for a couple of cable outlets and a nonfiction book, which at the moment is overdue at my publisher's.
Wouldn't be about Omnicom by any chance.
More than a chance.
Which explains why they put up such generous bail.
It wasn't for love. I did a little research on the two of you, by the way.
Why don't I feel flattered?
Says you had a promising career at the police department. Until your first big investigation had the collateral damage of bringing down a few highly placed cops. Anything to do with your leaving the department?
I'll do the interviews, okay?
And the professor, I didn't find much. Just one article says you work for the police sometimes, the defense sometimes, but always in the background, never in the spotlight.
Spotlight hurts my eyes. Why don't you tell us what happened the night of the murder after everyone left?
A flashback of the party guests leaving Nelson's house. Nelson and Cheryl are alone.
Who told you?
What difference does it make? It's true, isn't it?
Yes, it's true, but I want to know who blew my cover.
Well, I never betray a confidence. But if you're nice enough to me, just might make an exception.
You know, I don't know if you're sober enough to hear this, but you could really save yourself a headache and some possible jail time if you just tell me about your company's finances.
All right. We have all night.
He stumbles and passes out on the floor.
And I had to practically drag him into another room.
Is that when you left?
Not exactly. It seemed like a good time to do a little search. I tried to help myself, but I didn't find anything.
She hunts through drawers and cabinets.
And then the phone rang. It was another phone, not on the main system. It was a private line, I think. I was afraid it might wake him. And then I heard him coming and figured I'd had enough for one night, so I got out of there.
When would anybody have had the time to plant that bomb? Be interesting to know how long it had been there. Could have been a long time.
They knew he'd go to the phone. Yeah, I wonder why he didn't have voicemail in his private line.
Well, when he answered the phone, they probably pushed the remote button. You know how lucky you were to leave when you did?
So, how do we proceed?
We?
Look, it's my case, and I'm a very competent investigator.
Oh, I'm sure you're a hell of a journalist. But this is a criminal investigation.
I think what Mike is saying, we don't want to duplicate our efforts.
Exactly. That's why I'll be working right alongside him.
Jonathan and Mike exchange glances.
On this disc, I have some bios. There's some really good stuff in there. My guess would be whoever tipped me off to something wrong at Omnicom, they wanted me to get next to Raymond so they could frame me for his murder.
You don't have any idea who that is.
No, but I think that that's where I should start looking. We should start looking, if that's okay with you, naturally.
That's the one place I could use your help, for as long as it works.
You know, if you two could figure out who this whistleblower is, it would be one great big piece of the puzzle, one way or another. And I should start interviewing the suspects.
You know, Raymond's ex-wife was supposed to be at the party, but wasn't. Be nice to know why she didn't show.
Must have had a compelling reason.
And he sent me this photo.
Her on a street.
Where was this taken?
That's the building where he made the first drop with the note about Omnicom. And he cut all of the letters out of the financial press.
That doesn't tell you a lot.
No, just enough to get me interested. So I'll see you tomorrow?
I'll call you.
Okay.
John?
Mm-hmm. Oh.
He puts the evidence in his case.
I have to pick up some cat food.
Night.
Jonathan and Mike walk across Cheryl's garden.
So, what do you think?
I don't know. We really don't know what happened when she was alone with Raymond, or whether they were really involved or not, except for what she told us.
Well, at least if she's with me, I can keep an eye on her.
Well, I didn't say I was suspicious of her.
You didn't say you believed her either.
You know, it's possible she's being framed, unless we can find a motive, we have to assume she's innocent. Well, that's the theory anyway, isn't it?
They spot a parked car.
That car wasn't there when we got here.
So?
It's too dark, I can't read the plates.
You ought to wash that thing. Probably just a guest of a neighbor.
Yeah, maybe.
Take it easy in this thing, will you?
Fasten your seatbelt.
The filthy car has driven away. Mike and Jonathan drive off too. In a doctor's waiting room, Jonathan sits reading the TV guide.
Send in the next patient, please.
You're up.
Oh, thank you.
The receptionist returns to her magazine, and Jonathan steps into the office of Nelson's wife, red-headed Dr. Louise Raymond.
Dr. Raymond, I'm Dr. Maxwell, and I thank you for taking me on such short notice.
Well, always happy to accommodate a fellow professional. You can have a seat.
Oh, thank you.
Jonathan sits on a psychiatrist's couch. Louise sits on a chair beside him.
So, what seems to be bothering you?
Well, this isn't about me.
It never is.
No, seriously.
Doctor, please. Are you embarrassed discussing things with a woman?
Oh, no, nothing like that. I'm not here as a patient.
Perhaps you'd care to explain.
I am a professor of criminology, and at the moment I'm working as an advisor on the defense of Cheryl Collins.
The woman who killed Nelson.
Well, that hasn't been proven yet.
My marriage to Nelson was over some time ago, but that doesn't mean that I don't have feelings for him.
Oh, I understand perfectly.
They called me to go down to the morgue to identify his body. Not exactly the way I'd like to remember him. So I hope you don't expect me to be particularly cooperative.
I would only hope you'd be truthful.
That is my business.
Can you think of anybody who might have had a motive to kill him?
There are a lot of people damaged by Nelson. Omnicom is not the cozy little club they'd have you believe. But I guess you'd like to know if I have a motive.
Now that you mention it, yes.
Yes, I've been fighting with Nelson for the last few months over property settlement. It has to do with our divorce. Now that he's dead, I get it all. So I suppose you call that a motive.
Well, it qualifies.
Of course. The only problem with that is I wasn't there that evening.
Oh? Where were you?
Home. Alone. Reading a good mystery.
She hands him a printout.
What's that?
My bill. I get paid by the hour, Dr. Maxwell.
It comes to about $50 a question.
Jonathan, Mike, and Cheryl listen to a recording.
Miss Collins, if you do your homework, you'll find that Stellodyne Inc., Intertech, CompuFi are companies formed by Omnicom CFO Nelson Raymond in the last 90 days. And all of them have offshore accounts.
I did some checking with the Corporations Commission and confirmed that all three companies had in fact been set up by Raymond.
What about the offshore?
There's no evidence of that yet, but when the three companies didn't make it into the stockholders' report 60 days ago, I figured it was worth going after. What are you doing?
I'm trying to separate that background noise from the voice.
Need to take it to a lab?
This is a lab.
Oh, right. Sorry.
Okay, I think I got something.
Miss Collins, if you do your homework, you'll find that still...
Well, they've distorted the voice, so that means it most likely comes from a landline. Where's the call coming from?
Later, they walk with an older man who listens to an MP3 player.
Dr. Patterson isn't just the best ornithologist at this university. He is one of the best in the world.
What do you mean, one of the best?
Certainly the one with the best hearing.
What do you make of it, Doctor?
Very odd.
How odd?
Well, there are not only a lot of birds on here, but not ones you'd normally find together. Parrots, lovebirds, canaries, those are typical, but you've got what sounds like a Patagonian canure. And I think I hear an African ringneck.
Pet stores?
Well, possibly, but there's only maybe a dozen or so that would have that varied selection of birds.
What about an aviary?
Maybe. There's one in Santa Monica.
It's a start.
Winslow, thank you very much.
No problem.
You've been a big help, Dr. Patterson.
Easy enough. If you need anything else, just whistle.
He strolls off. He looks up.
Does he do that often?
Just in mating season.
A tall, modern concrete and glass building. Jonathan steps out of an elevator and walks along a corridor in a busy office.
He's not here right now. Can I voicemail or take a message?
Okay, last one.
Jonathan spots bald-headed Carl Larch preparing to be interviewed in front of a video camera.
All right, just make sure you keep me in frame. I only want to do one take, you got it? Okay, let's go. Omnicom isn't just the seventh largest corporation in California, and it's not that we make sure that our customers across the United States get the best possible value for our wide variety of products, from household goods to energy to insurance to the very television you're watching now. No, Omnicom is about people. I tell all my executives we don't own these offices. We're just occupying them on behalf of our customers. Whether it's that farmer in Iowa or that plumber in New Jersey, this company is here for them and their families. That's right. Most of all, we care about people. And we get mail from a lot of you out there. And we read every letter.
He takes a letter off his desk, then frowns.
Well, who put this here? This is from the SEC, for God's sake. Cut the camera. Cut the camera. Give me the tape. Give me the tape. Come on, the tape. All right, just leave. Get out of here. Out.
He shoves out the crew and closes his office door, then finds Jonathan sitting there.
Who the hell are you, and what are you doing here?
Professor Jonathan Maxwell, Mr. Larch.
What's this about? A grant or something? Do I have an appointment with you?
No, I'm a professor of criminology. I've been retained as part of the Cheryl Collins defense team.
Carl doesn't look thrilled, but sits down at his desk.
Well, I have to admit, I have a hard time believing she did it. I'm the one who hired her. Who knew she was a reporter, for God's sake? Now Raymond's death has brought the vultures out, spreading lies and rumors about this company.
Well, I'm glad to hear that. I mean that they are lies. You know, I bought some shares in the company. Just a few is all I can afford, but Omnicom seemed like the wave of the future.
Well, we still are, and we'll ride out this storm. There's absolutely no proof of any wrongdoing, just vicious insinuations.
Well, with your chief financial officer dead, it'd be hard for anybody to find any evidence. I mean, if there is any, there probably isn't any.
Well, if Cheryl Collins didn't kill Raymond, and I sincerely hope she didn't, I wish you the best of luck. Of course, if I get any thoughts, I'll give you a call.
I appreciate your cooperation. Oh, listen, there's a rumor that Mr. Raymond and your wife are having an affair.
Now, that's a lie. Who told you this?
I have these pictures taken a couple of weeks ago with Mr. Raymond and your wife. You have to admit they're a little compromising.
Jonathan shows him photos of Betty Larch and Nelson smiling and canoodling by a car.
Where did you get these?
Well, actually, they were taken by accident. When Miss Collins was tipped that there was something odd going on at Omnicom, she hired a photographer. He was just following Mr. Raymond there when he took these candid photos. You know, that's not bad for telephoto lens at low light. Wonder what he used.
Get out. Get out, or I'll have you thrown out.
I am sorry.
Just get out, and I hope Cheryl Collins gets what she deserves. Sweat.
Suppose that can be met.
After accidentally knocking over a statue, Jonathan scuttles out. Carl slams the door behind him. At a pet store, Cheryl crouches by a cage of exotic birds and records their calls with a small electronic device. Mike crouches beside her.
You know, this doesn't make a lot of sense. Why would your tipster make a call from here?
Shh, can't hear the birds.
Mike steps over to the woman at the till and shows her photos on his personal organizer.
Excuse me. Have you ever seen any of these people? Him or this woman or her? No? Okay, thanks.
Yep, here you go. Been a big help.
Mike walks over to a parrot and shows it the photos.
How about you? Recognize anyone? No?
Vintage grey convertible along a road in an upmarket residential area. He pulls up, takes a piece of paper out from between his teeth, and checks the address written on it. Jonathan grabs his battered leather messenger case and gets out of the car. He walks up a short flight of stone stairs to the front door of a large house, which has a sleek silver Mercedes parked in the drive.
Mr. Burke? Mr. Burke, this is Jonathan Maxwell. I'm working on the Cheryl Collins defense.
A large black saloon pulls up.
Won't take much time. It's better than having to answer a subpoena.
Sure you're alone?
Well, sure.
As Charles Burke answers the door, two burly heavies run up and barge in.
Well, just a minute. Who are you people?
You stay out of this.
Don't worry.
Why do you have to make everything so difficult?
Come on, I'm good for it, Vic.
I used to think that, which is why we loaned you the $100,000.
Working on a couple of things, liquidating some assets. Just need a little time.
Which is exactly what you've got, a little time, until noon tomorrow.
Don't worry.
I ain't gonna worry. I want you to worry.
Got it.
Good.
The heavies head out.
Keep your eye on your wallet.
Charles feels his crushed neck.
You all right?
Not exactly. Thanks for asking.
You know, I'm sorry to come at such a bad time, but I really need to talk to you.
I've got nothing to say. Just that I don't believe Cheryl was up to it, and I know I didn't. With Raymond's death, the company is under investigation, and as you can see, I've got some problems. Had a much brighter future if he was alive.
Do you have any idea who might have done it?
I really don't know. If I had a clue, I'd tell you. You certainly haven't done me any favors.
At home, Jonathan fixes a meal while Cheryl lays out plates and Mike opens a bottle of wine.
Well, I didn't have a lot of progress with my three interviews. The ex-wife and the CEO have personalities that could include homicidal tendencies, but Burke, not the type. Besides, he was too terrified to do much of anything.
Samantha watches hungrily.
You're in for a treat.
We didn't have much luck on the pet storefront either. We visited every single one that sells them.
Yep. We took the tape back to Professor Patterson, played him what we recorded. He said they didn't match.
You know, maybe your informer added the bird's house later.
Why would he do that?
Maybe to cover up the background.
Or maybe to add a background where there wasn't any.
They look at each other.
Been doing a little experimenting while you were out. A friend of mine over at the Department of Building Safety emailed me some plans that Raymond had approved for some remodeling on his house. Some of it included enlarging the basement. But here's the ground floor. Here. Now, when the phone rang, you were in the study. Then you heard footsteps and you left the house. And then Raymond came out of the bedroom and went to the cabinet where the phone was ringing and the bomb went off.
What's it supposed to tell us?
I timed Cheryl's walk to the car. It was a good 30 seconds before she actually got in the car and started the engine. You didn't hear the phone ringing outside, did you?
No.
It shouldn't have taken Raymond more than 5, maybe 10 seconds to get from the bedroom to the cabinet where that bomb was.
So what happened during the missing 20 to 25 seconds?
I don't know. We'll keep working on this model till we learn some more. Oh, here's the audio tape again. Now, this is without the bird sounds. They were pretty easy to fake out. Evidently, let them in later.
There's no ambient sound at all.
Exactly. But there's a slight reverberation around the voice. And that's not distortion either.
What's burning?
Samantha runs out through her cat flap.
I'm not going in there.
Jonathan wanders into the kitchen, and Cheryl looks concerned.
I mean, it's okay, it's all right. It's normal. He's just kicking it up a notch.
Jonathan trudges back in with blobs of food on his face.
Chinese? I'll call.
Mike picks up the phone and dials. In a courtroom, Jonathan sits in the public area as Betty Larch talks to the jury.
So, under the circumstances, and I think in the spirit of fairness, you should find for the defendant.
Thank you, Ms. Larch. I think this is a good time to call for a noon recess.
Bailiff?
All rise. This court stands in recess for 1 hour.
Jonathan comes over to Betty.
It was pretty slick.
Thank you, Professor Maxwell.
You were expecting me?
My husband described you perfectly and warned me that you might loom up unexpectedly.
Well, then you know I am here.
I have a pretty good idea. Any more of those so-called incriminating photos?
Oh, well, I've got some here. I wasn't going to show them to you, but I didn't want to embarrass you.
I don't easily embarrass.
Good, here they are.
She takes them.
Well, if you're hoping to cause troubles between my husband and I, you're sadly mistaken. Raymond was going through a difficult patch in his separation, and I was merely consoling him.
Oh, I see.
Raymond and I go all the way back to college together. When I explained what happened to my husband, he understood immediately.
Well, I'm sure that's a relief for you. I mean, given Raymond's reputation with the ladies, if he had dropped you and you thought that Cheryl was the new young thing...
I'm not the impulsive type, Professor.
Oh, I could see that. You were like a surgeon there with that cross-examination.
I'll take that as a compliment.
Incidentally, do you have any idea who it was contacted Cheryl Collins into tipping her to investigate Omnicom?
I wish I did. This company isn't in trouble, and all it's done is to stir up a lot of unfavorable publicity. Now, if you'll excuse me, I have to go. Don't you have to be somewhere?
You are somewhere, yes. Do you know if anybody here validates...
She strides off, leaving him with his parking slip.
I can tell you what level your car's on.
He picks up his case. Mike and Cheryl are on a slip road beside a large freeway heading over a bridge.
So this is where I was standing when they took the photo of me waiting for the drop.
How long were you waiting?
About 15 minutes. And then a kid on a bike handed me a manila envelope with the documents.
No idea who sent him, right?
No, I said a guy in a beat-up car gave him $10.
Excuse me. Bryant here. Oh, hi, Diane. Sure, yeah, I'll just meet you there. Yeah, I remember where your dad's beach club is. That's the one with all the sand, right? Ah, yeah, see you there.
Telling you what tie to wear?
Why do you suppose he sent the photo?
Messing with my head, mostly. Letting me know I'm being watched.
And making sure you come alone.
Mm-hmm. Well, from the angle of the photo, it was probably taken from up there.
I'm thinking third floor.
Mike crosses the road to a shabby red brick industrial building. At a country club, Jonathan walks between a line of golf buggies to a group of people standing around chubby grey-haired Max Arnholt, who holds a putter.
Good morning, and thank you all for coming to the 4th annual Omnicom Shareholders Best Ball Tournament. Before we tee off, I'd like to say just a few words. As you know, the tragic events surrounding the death of our colleague, Nelson Raymond, have generated a lot of rumors, innuendo, and speculation.
Max, if that's true, then why did financial press send in an undercover reporter?
Well, Patsy, as you should know, sometimes reporters will do anything, fabricate anything, go to any length just to concoct a story.
Max, after you were defeated in the congressional primary 2 years ago, now you signed on as the main lobbyist for Omnicom, isn't that true?
Well, that's no secret.
On the night of the murder, did you actually hear what Nelson Raymond and Cheryl Collins were arguing about?
No. I was outside with everyone else, but I could see through the window that there was a heated argument going on. By the way, do I know you? I don't ever remember seeing you at any of the stockholder meetings.
No, I wouldn't think so. I'm a professor of criminology. I'm working on the Cheryl Collins defense. I have five shares.
This is hardly the time and place. Getting back to the business at hand, I urge you all to wait for the next quarterly report due out in just a few weeks to decide for yourselves the health of Omnicom. Thank you all for coming. Good luck, and I'll see you out on the links. And later at the banquet.
Max gets into a golf buggy and shoots a glance back at Jonathan before trundling off. Jonathan hops into another buggy and puts his foot down, but it doesn't move. He presses a few buttons, but the buggy stays put.
Son of a gun died.
It suddenly zooms off. Mike walks up a stairwell with a balding middle-aged man.
You really a PI?
Sure am.
Cool. Okay.
He unlocks a door marked Operation Outreach.
You into the old detective shows?
Sure, I guess.
Yeah, because I sure am. I always thought I'd make a great private dick.
Well, you know, maybe you can help me out. This is about a piece of vital evidence. A photo that would have been taken about 4 weeks ago from this office window.
Really? This office?
Yep. Could you check and see who was here on the 23rd of last month?
Yeah, I sure can.
He checks a record.
Here we go. 23rd was a Tuesday. Looks like the same groups meet here every weekday evening.
Every weekday?
Yeah, except Wednesdays. Like today, the office is closed.
You don't say. You recognize any of these people?
No, but I don't usually hang around in the evenings.
Well, thanks for your time. We'll let you know if we need you in court.
Really? That would be great. What should I wear?
This looks good. This is nice.
Yeah, what about a tie?
No ties.
Really? Because I got a great tie my wife just gave me. It's paisley. I think you'd like it.
At the country club, Jonathan drives his golf buggy onto the links. He parks beside Max's buggy and leans out and waves. Max looks less than delighted to see him.
You're parked on the green.
Oh, sorry.
Jonathan draws forward a little and gets out.
Yeah, I'm really sorry. Just a couple of things I wanted to ask. Could you just tell me, did you get things patched up with Raymond before he died?
Nelson and I never had any problems, personal or otherwise.
Well, you know, there are several people who said they saw you having a heated argument, the two of you in the boardroom late at night, just the two of you. And then a young man from the mailroom said he saw you take a swing at Raymond. Is that true?
Well, if you must know, I was beginning to worry about his secretive way of doing business and whether or not it was going to affect the rest of us, put us in any kind of jeopardy or not. Words were exchanged. Truth be known, Nelson and I never really cared very much for each other's styles. He always thought that I was just another crooked politician. I always thought he was just a thief in an expensive suit.
Which one of you was right? Your phone.
Max strides over to his buggy, and Jonathan follows him.
I can't talk right now. Yes, I'll be there, of course.
Listen, do you miss being in Congress?
No, I don't. But I am missing the opportunity to prepare for this golf tournament, so if you'll just excuse me.
I'm sorry to bother you. You cleared up a couple of things for me. Thank you.
Well, that's just fine. That's mine.
Oh, sure is. Whoop! I'll get it.
Jonathan quickly checks the last call number on the phone.
You're right. That is yours. How do you like that? Head in my hand all the time.
Come on, you're next.
As he ambles away, Jonathan opens his mobile and dials the number he found on Max's phone.
Raymond, I can't take your call right now, but if you...
Jonathan hangs up with a wry smile. Mike comes out of the red brick building that houses the office of Operation Outreach. He jogs across the road to Cheryl, who's waiting by his car on the slip road. She's standing beside some newspaper vending machines.
Did you find out anything?
Yeah, not enough. I don't think anybody took your photo from that office. Yeah, but the office was closed the next day. So someone might have snuck in and taken the front of this building. They just wouldn't have had you in the shot. You, they put in later.
Someone's going through an awful lot of trouble to cover their tracks.
Where else did you go that day?
I went straight from my house to my publisher's office. Why?
Well, for one thing, what you're wearing would have been the same. I mean, even if the photos were changed. Let's go back to your place. I want to check something.
They climb into Mike's Porsche Carrera and drive away. At the country club, Max comes out of one of the buildings. He takes off his baseball cap, runs his fingers through his grey hair, and waves to someone.
How'd you hit him?
Mike smiles and pulls his car keys out of his pocket as he strides over to a large black Urban 4x4. Max gets into the 4x4, starts it up, and reverses out of the parking bay. Max drives out of the parking lot watched by Jonathan, who's parked up in a nearby bay. Jonathan backs up and drives after Max. Max drives up to the entrance of a tall, modern hotel. He gets out of his car and a valet steps over. The valet gets into the car and Max strolls through the hotel entrance. Jonathan stops his silver-grey convertible behind Max's car as the valet puts on a seatbelt. Jonathan gets out of his car and hands the keys to another valet. Jonathan steps into the lobby of the hotel and sees Max talking to the reception clerk. Jonathan quickly steps up to a pillar and hides behind it as Max walks away from the reception desk and gets into a lift. Jonathan watches closely as Max presses the button for a floor. A young woman in the lift presses the button for another floor and the doors close. Scowling a little, Jonathan turns round and sees Carl Larch saunter into the lobby. Jonathan quickly hides and watches to see what button Carl presses. He presses a button for the 11th floor, then a little kid runs into the lift and presses the buttons for all the floors. Carl glares at the kid as the lift doors close. Jonathan sighs and walks over to the emergency stairwell. Jonathan climbs the stairs, passing several landings. Finally, he makes it to the 11th floor and staggers out into the corridor. He leans against a wall and catches his breath, then cautiously peers around a corner as Carl comes out of the lift. Jonathan surreptitiously follows Carl, who knocks on the door of the presidential suite. Max answers.
Hey, Carl. First one here.
Carl goes in and Max closes the door behind them. Jonathan steps towards the room, then quickly scuttles off as Betty Larch and Dr. Louise Raymond walk up the corridor. Jonathan hides behind a maid's trolley and peers out to watch Betty and Louise make their way towards the presidential suite. Jonathan looks at the room next door, which is open and being cleaned by the maid. He sneaks in and silently creeps past the bathroom where the maid is changing towels. Jonathan opens the French window and steps onto the balcony, then balks at the height. He carefully closes the window behind him, then climbs over the balcony railing. Jonathan, wearing sporty trainers, carefully sidesteps along the outside of the railing towards the balcony of the presidential suite. He nervously blows out his cheeks and looks down at the concrete pavement 11 floors below him. Jonathan climbs across to the presidential balcony and clambers over the railing. He steps towards the window, while in the room he just came from, the maid locks the French windows he came through and closes the curtain. In the presidential suite, Max, Louise, Carl and Betty are having a drink.
Well, I'm sorry to drag you all down here, but under the circumstances we have to keep a low profile.
What circumstances, exactly?
The SEC is looking into our records, and they're going to see that Raymond was cooking the books.
With Nelson's unfortunate death, we have the opportunity to just circle the wagons and protect ourselves.
You mean lay all the blame on poor dead Nelson?
I know it sounds cold-blooded, Louise, but nothing we can do can bring Nelson back.
And we all stand to profit.
I've spoken to a couple of sympathetic investment houses, and they'll help us weather the storm.
Nobody wants to see another Enron.
Which can't happen because Nelson's records were destroyed in the fire. And there aren't any other copies, are there, Louise?
No, I happen to know there aren't. And I'm happy to hear we're all going to profit. I assume that does include the Merry Widow, me?
Absolutely.
Could you be more specific?
We're prepared to buy your inherited shares at the market price before this tragedy. As a show of good faith on the part of the company, and as compensation for your suffering.
Well, that sounds very compassionate. So, where is Mr. Charles Burke? Isn't he a member of your team?
He knew about this meeting. I talked to him this morning.
Doesn't that seem a little bit suspicious?
They all check their mobiles. The phone ringing is actually Jonathan's. He yanks it out of his pocket, fumbles with it, and drops it. It smashes on the pavement far below. In the suite.
Well, if we're all agreed, I'd say this meeting could adjourn.
I'd like a cashier's check. Delivered to me today.
You'll get it.
Oh, and by the way, in case you're wondering, I'm not having a memorial service. I'm sure he would have wanted it that way.
Louise leaves.
Hang around her long enough and you'll catch cold.
This had better work out.
The sooner she gets that check, the better. It's our insurance policy.
I just don't want to be the next executive to end up in prison.
Don't worry, Max. We're all in this together. We're family.
Oh, Max. Get some rest.
She heads for the balcony.
Don't worry.
Jonathan makes a quick escape to the neighboring balcony as Betty steps onto the balcony, followed by Carl.
What if Cheryl didn't kill Nelson?
So what if she did?
Then one of us did.
So what?
Well, if one of us gets caught, say by your professor, he or she could bring our whole stack of cards down.
Maybe we should let the jury sort it all out.
Personally, if I had to bet, I'd put my money on Louise. Unlike the rest of us, she's not just protecting herself. After all, she's coming out way ahead.
Maybe she did. Do you care?
No. I don't.
She comes back in.
I'll see you later.
Jonathan tries to get back into the room he came through, but the window is, of course, locked. He closes his eyes and sighs, then looks back towards the presidential suite. Jonathan clambers back across the railings to the presidential suite. He climbs over onto the balcony and collapses in an exhausted heap. Jonathan gets to his feet, strides through the open window, and makes his way to the door, just as Carl comes in and spots him.
How in the world did you get in here?
It wasn't easy.
Jonathan leaves and Carl takes a gulp of his drink. Cheryl walks through her garden with Mike.
So I came up this way and closed the door, went to my car, and then I got a phone call. So I had to look for my phone. Of course, it was the wrong number.
So you were standing about here?
Yeah.
Mike looks at a grassy ridge over the road.
That photographer had to be close. You know, that photo could have been taken from up there.
Mike looks up at the trees on top of the ridge, then glances back at Cheryl. Louise is in her office as Jonathan knocks on the open door.
Your reception seems to be out of lunch. Going somewhere?
I'm getting away for a while. Need a little time to myself.
Well, at least you know you can afford any vacation you want now.
What's that supposed to mean?
Well, I mean, you're coming into some money. We have that cashier's check already, huh?
I think you'd better go.
You know, it might interest you to know that your co-conspirators at Omnicom think you might be the one who killed your husband.
Leave, or I'll call security.
You know, I wouldn't be leaving town just yet. The police might want to talk to you.
He smiles and leaves, closing the door behind him. Louise quickly gets on the phone.
Yeah, that professor was here again. He knows a lot more than he should. Well, we'd better do something.
She hangs up and sighs nervously. Mike stands up on the grassy ridge, taking photos of Cheryl, who stands in the front drive of her house, staring up at him. Mike notices the dirty saloon that was parked there a few nights earlier. He takes a few photos of the car, and it quickly drives away. He runs down to Cheryl.
Let's go!
What are we doing?
I've seen that car twice before. It was cruising us when we were downtown.
Cheryl gets into Mike's Porsche and buckles up as he speeds off after the saloon. The saloon drives up over a hill and Mike's Porsche motors after it. Mike chases the saloon down a road. The saloon overtakes a large truck, which then turns left across the road, forcing Mike to screech to a halt. Mike swerves round the truck and Cheryl shoots him a nervous glance.
You are good at this, right?
We haven't lost one yet.
One what?
The saloon slews right into a parking lot surrounded by wire mesh fencing, topped with loops of barbed wire. Mike follows it in, then slows his Porsche to a halt.
Why is this joker going into a junkyard?
Edgar Allan Poe.
The purloined letter.
Where'd he hide a beat-up car?
With all the others. Wait here.
Cheryl stays in the passenger seat as Mike gets out of the Porsche. He swaggers through the gate of the junkyard, which is filled with tatty old cars. Cheryl gets out of the Porsche and steps up to the gate to watch. Mike walks up to a row of shabby old cars and looks at them. Suddenly, an old banger with a price painted on the window screeches out from another row and tries to ram him. Mike jumps up onto the roof of a car as the banger hits the side of another. The banger reverses and rams the car Mike's lying on. Mike jumps down, pulls his gun and shoots at the banger, which collides with another car and speeds off. Mike fires several more shots at the back of the banger and it stops. Mike paces over to the car and looks inside, but it's now empty. Suddenly, a truck pulls out and drives off. Mike gets off a shot, but the truck escapes. He runs back to the Porsche and Cheryl.
So much for that.
Not necessarily.
He holsters his gun and runs back into the junkyard. Jonathan drives his vintage convertible over to Charles Burke's house and parks up. Jonathan jogs up the stone steps and urgently thumps on the front door.
Mr. Burke? Mr. Burke, it's Jonathan Maxwell. Mr. Burke!
He looks around, then runs across the road. The two heavy loan sharks are asleep in a parked car, and Jonathan wakes them.
Hey, Man in Black.
What?
I think we have to get into Burke's house.
Why?
The men get out.
What's going
on? This guy's more trouble is worth.
What do you say, Vic?
Jonathan follows the heavies to the door. The boss tries to shoulder barge it, then turns to his accomplice.
Shoot it!
The younger guy draws a pistol and aims at the lock. The boss goes in.
Burke? Burke!
Mr. Burke?
That little weasel ain't in here.
Mr. Burke?
Hey, Burke!
Jonathan looks into a room, then goes through into the kitchen.
Burke, come on out.
Jonathan sees Charles Burke lying motionless on the kitchen floor. He strides over, crouches down, and feels for a pulse in Charles's neck. Jonathan takes his hands away and looks up at a worktop. A bottle of pills stands open with a few more pills scattered beside it. Jonathan stands up and examines the pill bottle. He sighs as the heavies come in and survey the scene. Night. Jonathan sits in front of his computer with Mike and Cheryl standing behind him, watching over his shoulder.
Okay, here's Cheryl in front of her house. Now we'll lift her out of that photo and clone her over here.
You know, whoever did this, sophisticated, technically.
Not that sophisticated.
What do you mean?
Look, here. Can you zoom in on that newspaper?
Yeah.
There, that headline.
I'm missing something.
Well, this is Wednesday's newspaper with Tuesday's election results.
I'll be darned. Yep, Mike, you good.
Well, he's bound to trip up sooner or later. He almost did with that stolen car.
You know, maybe we just turned the heat up enough to force his hand. The big question is, what does this mysterious whistleblower have to do with Louise Raymond? You know, I'm going to do a little checking around on the internet, see what I can find out. This could take me a while, kid.
Come on, I'll take you home.
See you later.
Have fun.
Mike and Cheryl leave. Fluffy white Samantha hops up onto Jonathan's desk.
Hey, Samantha, baby. Curiosity killed the cat, you know.
Mike's Porsche parks up outside Cheryl's house. Mike and Cheryl get out and step through the wooden door leading them into the garden. They walk through the dark garden together. Mike suddenly sees something, stops Cheryl and draws his gun.
Stay here.
Cheryl's door is ajar. Mike stalks towards it, pushes it open and steps inside. Cheryl follows him in. They silently stalk downstairs into the living area. The French windows are open and the room has been ransacked.
So much for changing the locks.
They weren't after you. They didn't get your records the first time around and they were just protecting themselves.
Oh, they took my entire computer system. For all the good it'll do them.
Nothing else if thorough.
Well, they didn't get anything because I don't have anything.
She folds her arms.
This isn't going well, is it?
Believe it or not, we are making progress. And we are far from beaten.
Thanks, Mike. Used to being on the outside, looking in. A lot easier.
You know, I don't think you should stay here tonight.
Any suggestions? Like your place?
Actually, that is the suggestion. I have a spare bedroom. Fold up, actually.
She smiles and looks around.
What are we looking at here?
Thanks. This is the electrical plot for the remodel Raymond did at his house.
Look how many electrical outlets he's got in there. Must have used it for a workshop or something.
The fire department said the basement was empty.
Yeah. Why remodel your basement and then empty it out just before the explosion?
Are you suggesting that Louise Raymond knows how to make a bomb?
I'm suggesting she might have had help. Cheryl, I want you to find out everything you can about Louise Raymond when we need it right away. Look, Mike, check with your friend at the phone company.
Jimmy?
Yeah, find out how many calls she made to her husband, when and how often. And also check on your hunch about the donator rack, too. Meet me back here as soon as you can.
Right.
Hello. Dr. Raymond going on a holiday today?
Yes. And she's asked me not to take any appointments until she returns.
What cruise line is she taking?
She wouldn't take a ship. Her husband had a boat and he couldn't even get her to go out on it.
Oh, really? Where's the boat docked?
I have no idea.
Yeah.
I got a fairly complete bio on Louise Raymond. She went to medical school, specialized in psychiatry, married Raymond about 12 years ago.
Anything more recent at all?
A lot of charity work. Most recent is the Veterans Administration.
Ah, when'd she start that?
A couple months ago.
That makes sense. Listen, Raymond had a boat. Do you have any idea where it's docked?
As a matter of fact, I do.
Oh, good. I gotta get there before it's too late.
What's the matter?
Have you seen my car keys?
Come on, I'll take you.
Okay.
Where'd I put my cell phone? Oh, it's among the missing. Better call Mike and tell him where we are.
I can handle that.
He's not answering.
Better keep trying it.
What are you doing here?
Oh, I would have been here sooner, but I had to piece together your seasickness medicine with your husband's yacht. Took me a while. And then when I found out, of course, that you worked at a VA hospice, everything just fell together.
Both of you, on the boat.
Get on the boat.
I got it. Get your hands down.
Okay. You know, it wasn't a bad plan. You're working at the VA, had access to a corpse, somebody with no family, nobody would ever inquire about him. But there was a 20-second discrepancy between the time it took you to come from the bedroom alone and answer the phone. But that was the time it took you two to place the body. That's a narrow window of opportunity, but smart people like you wouldn't leave anything to chance. I bet you rehearsed it until you had it down, including the phone call and the time to get outside to a safe place and set off the explosion. You know what was the really nice touch? When you identified the body as your husband. I mean, nobody would question whether he was dead or not. Especially when the grieving widow shows up to identify her ex-husband's body. I'll bet you really put on a show for the sympathetic people who walked you through the process down at the morgue. And you were the mysterious whistleblower. That put you in the driver's seat from the word go. You pulled Cheryl in by dangling a huge story in front of her. And made her your unwitting accomplice. You recorded that message in your basement, and then removed all the equipment that could be traced to you. You managed a lot of moving pieces for a dead man. You almost got away with it. Except when we started nosing around, you got a little nervous, and you decided to skip out before you had planned. And he wasn't going to leave you behind to get cold feet. So he insisted you get on the boat with him. You'll tell me if I left anything out.
Unfortunately, you're not going to get a chance to prove any of this.
No, he insisted you get on the boat right away. That way he could see that he got the cashier's check himself and you would disappear somewhere out at sea.
And then he could keep everything for himself.
What exactly is the big rush? I was supposed to meet you in a few months after Cheryl was convicted.
Don't listen to him. Just get on the boat.
I don't think so.
You're not thinking clearly. I said get on board.
I don't think this is working, Mr. Raymond.
If I were you, I would just call this off.
You know, actually, I just need you to stand still for a few seconds, okay?
What?
He doesn't swim very well.
No,
that was great.
Thank you.
Help!
I got the plate number off the fire wreck that he left at the lock. I remember there were parking restrictions at Cheryl's place, and figured maybe he got a ticket. He did. And rather than risk getting pulled over, he paid it.
Oh, and some of the phone calls from his wife were from the ship-to-shore phone on the boat, so I figured maybe he was holed up here.
Nice work.
Do I get an A?
Well, nobody's perfect. A minus. You get an E for effort.
All charges against my client have been dropped, and Dr. and Mrs. Raymond have been arrested for criminal conspiracy. I'll take questions now.
Miss St. John, will your client be testifying in the trial?
Well, seems like a good time to sell my Omnicom stock.
You may be a little late. According to the newspaper, it is sinking fast.
Well, for once, I don't know what to say. I owe the two of you my life. 20 years of it anyway.
Well, 10 maybe with good behavior.
Thank you.
I'll walk you out.
Okay.
Thank you.
interested in some dinner?
Oh, I'd really love to, but I have a meeting with my publisher to talk about the book on this case.
That shouldn't be a total loss.
Besides, don't you have plans with Diane?
Actually, I've been fired as her fiancé.
Sorry about that.
That's okay. I was going to quit anyway.
Well, the really nice thing about dinner is you can do it on any given night. Like, say, tomorrow.
Well, an actual date.
I guess you could call it that.
I guess I will.